Forgetting was not so easy for Thomas. He was haunted for weeks by nightmares. In them, his father stared at him and shrieked, "See what you've done to me!" and threw his robe open to display his nakedness. Old puckered scars, drooping belly, sagging muscles, as if to say this too had all been horrible. But Thomas did have courage, and he sometimes found it, usually when his back was to the wall. His father gave him a kiss and asked if anything was wrong. Thomas muttered that he hadn't been feeling well, but now he felt fine. His father nodded, gave him a rough hug, then went back to his usual behavior, which consisted mostly of ignoring Thomas in favor of Peter. For once, Thomas welcomed this. He didn't want his father looking at him any more than necessary, at least for a while. That night, lying awake for a long time in bed and listening to the wind moan outside, he came to the conclusion that he had had a very close shave, but that he had somehow gotten away with it. But never again, he thought. In the weeks after, the nightmares came less and less frequently. Finally, they stopped altogether. Still, the castle's head groom, Yosef, was right about one thing. Boys are sometimes better at pledging vows than they are at keeping them, and Thomas's desire to spy on his father at last grew stronger than both his fears and his good intentions. And that is how it happened that on the night Flag came to Roland with the poisoned wine, Thomas was watching. 29. When Thomas got there and slid aside the two little panels, his father and his brother were just finishing their nightly glass of wine together. Peter was now almost 17, tall and handsome. The two of them sat by the fire, drinking and talking like old friends, and Thomas felt the old hate fill his heart with acid. After some little time, Peter arose and took courteous leave of his father. "You leave earlier and earlier these nights," Roland remarked. Peter made some demur. Roland smiled. It was a sweet, sad smile, mostly toothless. "I hear," said he, "that she is lovely." Peter looked flustered, which was uncommon with him. He stammered, which was even less common. "Go," Roland interrupted. "Go. Be gentle with her, and be kind. But be hot, if there is ardor in you." "Yes, Peter. Be hot while your years are green, and fuel is plentiful, and the fire may burn high." Peter smiled. "You speak as if you are very old, Father, but you still look strong and hale to me." Roland embraced Peter. "I love you," he said. Peter smiled with no awkwardness or embarrassment. "I love you too, Dad," he said. And in his lonely darkness, spying is always lonely work, and the spyer almost always does it in the dark, Thomas pulled a horrible face. Peter left, and for an hour or more, not much happened. Roland sat morosely by the fire, drinking glass after glass of beer. He did not roar or bellow or talk to the heads on the walls. There was no destruction of furniture. Thomas had almost made up his mind to leave when there was a double rap at the door. Roland had been looking into the fire, almost hypnotized by the flicker play of the flames. Now he roused himself and called, "Who comes?" Thomas heard no response, but his father rose and went to the door as if he had. He opened it, and at first Thomas thought his father's habit of talking to the heads on the walls had taken a queer new turn, that his father was now inventing invisible human company to relieve his boredom. "Strange to see you here at this hour," Roland said, apparently walking back toward the fire in the company of no one at all. "I thought you were always at your spells and conjurations after dark." Thomas blinked, rubbed his eyes, and saw that someone was there after all. For a moment he couldn't rightly make out who, and then he wondered how he could possibly have thought his father was alone when Flag was right there beside him. Flag was carrying two glasses of wine on a silver tray. "Wives' tale, my lord. Magicians conjure early as well as late. But, of course, we have our darksome image to keep up." Roland's sense of humor was always improved by beer, so much so that he would often laugh at things that weren't funny in the least. At this remark, he threw back his head and bellowed, as if it was the greatest joke he had ever heard. Flagg smiled thinly. When Roland's fit of laughing had passed, he said, "What's this? Wine?" "Your son is barely more than a boy, but his deference toward his father and his honor of his king have shamed me, a grown man," Flagg said. "I brought you a glass of wine, my king, to show you that I too love you." He passed it to Roland, who looked absurdly touched.
"Don't drink it, father," Thomas thought suddenly.
His mind was full of an alarm he couldn't understand. Roland's head came up suddenly and tilted almost as if he had heard. "He's a good boy, my Peter," Roland said. "Indeed," Flagg replied. "Everyone in the kingdom says so."
"Do they?"
Roland asked, looking pleased.
"Do they indeed?"
"Yes, so they do. Shall we toast him?" Flagg raised his glass.
"No, father,"
Thomas shouted in his mind again, but if his father had heard his first thought, he didn't hear this one. His face shone with love for Thomas's older brother.
"To Peter, then."
Roland raised the glass of poisoned wine high.
"To Peter,"
Flagg agreed, smiling.
"To the king."
Thomas cringed in the dark. Flagg's making two different toasts. I don't know what he means, but...
"Father."
This time it was Flagg who turned his darkly considering gaze toward the dragon's head for a moment, as if he had heard the thought. Thomas froze, and in a moment Flagg's gaze turned back to Roland. They clinked glasses and drank. As his father quaffed the glass of wine, Thomas felt a splinter of ice push its way into his heart. Flagg made a half turn in his chair and threw his glass into the fire.
"Peter!"
"Peter!" Roland echoed and threw his own. It smashed against the sooty brickwork at the back of the fireplace and fell into the flames, which for a moment seemed to flare an ugly green. Roland raised the back of his hand to his mouth for a moment, as if to stifle a belch.
"Did you spice it?"
he asked.
"It tasted almost mulled."
"No, my lord," Flagg said gravely. But Thomas thought he sensed a smile behind the mask of the magician's gravity, and that splinter of ice slipped further into his heart. Suddenly he wanted no more of spying, not ever. He closed the peepholes and crept back to his room. He felt first hot, then cold, then hot again. By morning he had a fever. Before he was well again, his father was dead. His brother imprisoned in the room at the top of the needle, and he was a boy king at the age of barely 12. Thomas the Lightbringer, he was dubbed at the coronation ceremonies. And who was his closest advisor? You guess. 30. When Flagg left Roland, the old man was feeling sprightlier than ever by then. A sure sign the dragon's hand was at work in him. He went back to his dark basement rooms. He got out the tweezers and the packet containing the remaining few grains of sand and put them on his huge old desk. Then he turned his hourglass over and resumed reading. Outside, the wind screamed and gobbled. Old wives cringed in their beds and slept poorly and told their husbands that Rhiannon, the dark witch of the coos, was riding her hateful broom this night and wicked work was afoot. The husbands grunted, turned over, told their wives to go back to sleep and leave them alone. They were dull fellows for the most part. When an eye is wanted to see straws flying in the wind, give me an old wife any day. Once a spider skittered halfway across Flagg's book, touched a spell so terrible not even the magician dared use it, and turned instantly to stone. Flagg grinned. When the hourglass was empty, he turned it over again, and again, and again. He turned it over 8 times in all, and when the 8th hour's worth of sand was nearly gone, he set about finishing his work.
He kept a large number of animals in a dim room down the hall from his study, and he went there first. The little creatures skittered and cringed when Flagg came near. He did not blame them. In the far corner was a wicker cage containing half a dozen brown mice. Such mice were everywhere in the castle, and that was important. Down here there were also huge rats, but it was not a rat Flagg wanted tonight. The royal rat upstairs had been poisoned. A simple mouse would be enough to make sure the crime came home to the royal ratling. If all went well, Peter would soon be as tightly locked up as these mice. Flagg reached into the cage and removed one. It trembled wildly in his cupped hand. He could feel the rapid thrumming of its heart, and he knew that if he simply held it, it would soon die of fright. Flagg pointed the little finger of his left hand at the mouse. The fingernail glowed faintly blue for a moment. "Sleep," the magician commanded, and the mouse fell on its side and went to sleep on his open palm. Flagg took it back into his study and laid it on his desk, where the obsidian paperweight had rested earlier. Now he went into his larder and drew a little mead from an oaken barrel into a saucer. He sweetened it with honey. He put it on his desk, then went out into the corridor and breathed deeply at the window again. Holding his breath, he came back in and used the tweezers to pour all but the last 3 or 4 grains of dragon sand into the honey-sweetened mead. Then he opened another drawer of his desk and removed a fresh packet, which was empty. Then, reaching all the way to the back of his drawer, he brought out a very special box. The fresh packet was bewitched, but its magic was not very strong. It would hold the dragon sand safely only for a short while. Then it would begin to work on the paper. It would not set it alight, not inside the box. There would not be air enough for that. But it would smoke and smolder, and that would be enough. That would be fine. Flagg's chest was thudding for air, but he still spared a moment to look at this box and congratulate himself. He had stolen it 10 years ago. If you had asked him at the time why he took it, he would have known no more than he knew why he had shown Thomas the secret passage that ended behind the dragon's head. That instinct for mischief had told him to take it, and that he would find a use for it. So he had. After all those years in his desk, that useful time had come. Peter was engraved across the top of the box. Sasha had given it to her boy. He had left it for a moment on a table in the hallway when he had to run down the hallway after something or other. Flagg came along, saw it, and popped it into his pocket. Peter had been grief-stricken, of course, and when a prince is upset, even a prince who is only 6 years old, people take notice. There had been a search, but the box had never been found. Using the tweezers, Flagg carefully poured the last few grains of dragon sand from the original packet, which had been wholly enchanted, into the packet which had been only incompletely enchanted. Then he went back to the window in the corridor to draw fresh breath. He did not breathe again until the fresh packet had been laid in the antique wooden box, the tweezers laid in there beside it, the top of the box slowly closed, and the original packet disposed of in the sewer. Flagg was hurrying now, but he felt secure enough. Mouse sleeping, box closed, incriminating evidence safely latched inside. It was very well. Pointing the little finger of his left hand at the mouse lying stretched out on his desk like a fur rug for pixies, Flagg commanded, "Wake!" The mouse's feet twitched. Its eyes opened. Its head came up. Smiling, Flagg wiggled his little finger in a circle and said, "Run!" The mouse ran in circles. Flagg wiggled his finger up and down. "Jump!" The mouse began to jump on its hind legs like a dog in a carnival, its eyes rolling wildly. "Now drink," Flagg said, and pointed his little finger at the dish holding the honey-sweetened mead. Outside, the wind gusted to a roar. On the far side of the city, a bitch gave birth to a litter of 2-headed pups. The mouse drank. "Now," said Flagg, when the mouse had drunk enough of the poison to serve his purpose, sleep again. And the mouse did. Flag hurried to Peter's rooms. The box was in one of his many pockets. Magicians have many, many pockets. And the sleeping mouse was in another. He passed several servants and a laughing gaggle of drunken courtiers, but none saw him. He was still dim. Peter's rooms were locked, but that was no problem for one of Flag's talents. Three passes with his hands and the door was open. The young prince's rooms were empty, of course. The boy was still with his lady friend. Flag didn't know as much about Peter as he did about Thomas, but he knew enough. He knew, for instance, where Peter kept the few treasures he thought worth hiding away. Flag went directly to the bookcase and pulled out three or four boring textbooks. He pushed at a wooden edging and heard a spring click back. He then slid a panel aside, revealing a recess in the back of the case. It was not even locked. In the recess was a silk hair ribbon his lady had given him, a packet of letters she had written him, a few letters from him to her, which burned so brightly he did not dare to send them, and a little locket with his mother's picture inside it. Flag opened the engraved box and very carefully shredded one corner of the packet's flap. Now it looked as if a mouse had been chewing at it. Flag closed the lid again and put the box in the recessed space. "You cried so when you lost this box, dear Peter," he murmured. "I think you may cry even more when it's found." He giggled. He put the sleeping mouse beside the box, closed the compartment, and put the books neatly back in place. Then he left and slept well. Great mischief was afoot, and he felt confident that he had moved as he liked to move, behind the scenes, seen by no one. 31. For the next 3 days, King Roland seemed healthier, more vigorous, and more decisive than anyone had seen him in years. It was the talk of the court. Visiting his ill and feverish brother in his apartments, Peter remarked to Thomas in awe that what remained of their father's hair actually seemed to be changing color, from the baby-fine, wispy white it had been for the last 4 years or so, to the iron gray it had been in Roland's middle years. Thomas smiled, but a fresh chill raced through him. He asked Peter for another blanket, but it wasn't really a blanket he needed. He needed to unsee that final strange toast, and that, of course, was impossible. Then, after dinner on the third day, Roland complained of indigestion. Flag offered to have the court physician summoned. Roland waved the suggestion away, saying that he felt fine, actually, better than he had in months, in years. He belched. It was a long, arid, rattling sound. The convivial crowd in the ballroom fell silent with wonder and apprehension as the king doubled over. The musicians in the corner ceased playing. When Roland straightened up, a gasp ran through those present. The king's cheeks were aflame with color. Smoking tears ran from his eyes. More smoke drifted from his mouth. There were perhaps 70 people in that great dining hall, rough-dressed riders, what we would call knights, I suppose, sleek courtiers and their ladies, attendants upon the throne, courtesans, jesters, musicians, a little troop of actors in one corner who had been going to put on a play later, servants in great numbers. But it was Peter who ran to his father. It was Peter they all saw going to the doomed man, and this did not displease Flag at all. Peter. They would remember it had been Peter. Roland clutched his stomach with one hand and his chest with the other. Smoke suddenly poured out of his mouth in a gray-white plume. It was as if the king had learned some amazing new way of telling the story of his greatest exploit. But it was no trick, and there were screams as smoke poured not only from his mouth, but from his nostrils, ears, and the corners of his eyes. His throat was so red it was nearly purple. "Dragon!" King Roland shrieked as he collapsed into his son's arms. "Dragon!" It was the last word he ever spoke. 32. The old man was tough, incredibly tough. Before he died, he was throwing off so much heat that no one, not even his most loyal servants, could approach closer to his bed than 4 feet. Several times they threw buckets of water on the poor dying king when they saw the bedclothes beginning to smolder. Each time the water turned instantly to steam that billowed through his bedchamber and out into the sitting room where courtiers and riders stood in numb silence and ladies clustered, weeping and wringing their hands. Just before midnight, a jet of green flame shot from his mouth, and he died. Flagg went solemnly to the door between the bedchamber and the sitting room and announced the news. There followed an utter silence that stretched out for more than a minute. It was broken by a single word which came from somewhere in the gathered crowd. Flagg did not know who spoke that one word, and he did not care. It was enough that it had been spoken. Indeed, he would have bribed a man to speak it, if such could have been done with no danger to him. "Murder," this someone said. There was a universal gasp. Flagg raised a solemn hand to his mouth to hide a smile. 33. The court physician amplified one word to three. Murder by poison. He did not say murder by dragon sand, for the poison was unknown in Delane, except to Flagg. The king died shortly before midnight, but by dawn the charge was rife in the city, and spreading outward toward the far reaches of the eastern, western, southern, and northern baronies. Murder. Regicide. Roland the Good, dead by poison. Even before then, Flagg had organized a search of the castle, from the highest point, the eastern tower, to the lowest, the dungeon of Inquisition, with its racks and manacles and squeezing boots. Any evidence bearing on this terrible crime, he said, must be searched out and reported at once. The castle rang with the search. 600 grimly eager men combed through it. Only two small areas of the castle were exempt. These were the apartments of the two princes, Peter and Thomas. Thomas was barely aware of this. His fever had worsened to the point where the court physician had become deeply alarmed. He lay in a delirium as dawn's first light fingered its way into his windows. In his dreams, he saw two glasses of wine raised high, heard his father say again and again, "Did you spice it? It tasted mulled." Flagg had ordered the search, but by 2 in the morning, Peter had recovered enough of his wits to take charge of it. Flagg let him. These next few hours would be terribly important, a time when all could be won or lost, and Flagg knew it. The king was dead. The kingdom was momentarily headless. But not for long. This very day, Peter would be crowned king at the foot of the needle, unless the crime was brought home to the boy quickly and conclusively. Under other circumstances, Flagg knew, Peter would have been under suspicion at once. People always suspect those who have the most to gain, and Peter had gained a great deal by his father's death. Poison was horrible, but poison might have won him a kingdom. But in this case, the people of the kingdom spoke of the boy's loss rather than the boy's gain. Of course, Thomas had lost his father, too, they might add after a pause, almost as if they were ashamed of the momentary lapse. But Thomas was a sullen, sulky, awkward boy who had often argued with his father. Peter's affection and respect for Roland, on the other hand, were known far and wide. And why, people would ask, if the monstrous idea was even raised, and so far it had not been, why would Peter kill his father for the crown when he would surely inherit it in a year, or 3, or 5? If evidence of the crime were to be found in the secret place that only Peter knew, however, a place in the prince's own rooms, the tide would turn quickly. People would begin to see a murderer's face beneath a mask of affection and respect. They would point out that to the young, a year may seem like 3, 3 like 9, 5 like 25. Then they would point out that the king had seemed, in the last few days of his life, to be coming out of a long, dark time, had seemed to be growing hale and vigorous again. Perhaps, they would say, Peter had believed his father was entering a long, healthy Indian summer, had panicked and done something as foolish as it was monstrous. Flagg knew something else. He knew that people have a deep and instinctive distrust of all kings and princes, for these are people who may order their deaths with a single nod, and for crimes as petty as dropping a handkerchief in their presence. Great kings are loved. Lesser kings are tolerated. Kings-to-be represent a scary unknown quantity. They might come to love Peter if given a chance, but Flagg knew they would also condemn him quickly if shown enough evidence. Flagg thought such evidence would be forthcoming soon. Nothing more than a mouse, small, but big enough in its way to shake a kingdom to its foundations. 34. In Delane there were only three stages of being: childhood, half-manhood or womanhood, and adulthood. These half-years lasted from 14 to 18. When Peter entered half-manhood, the scolding nannies were replaced with Brandon, his butler, and Dennis, Brandon's son. Brandon would be Peter's butler for years yet, but probably not forever. Peter was very young, and Brandon was nearing 50. When Brandon was no longer able to buttle, Dennis would take over. Brandon's family had buttled high royalty for nearly 800 years and were justifiably proud of the fact. Dennis rose each morning at 5 o'clock, dressed, laid out his father's suit, and shined his father's shoes. Then he wandered blearily into the kitchen and ate breakfast. At 5:45, he set out from the family's home on the west side of the castle keep and entered the castle proper by the lesser west door. Promptly at 6 o'clock, he would reach Peter's rooms, let himself quietly in, and go about the early chores, building a fire, making 6 breakfast muffins, heating water for tea. Then he would quickly circle the three rooms, setting them to rights. This was usually easy, because Peter was not a messy boy. Last of all, he would return to the study and lay out breakfast, for the study was where Peter liked to eat the meals he took in his rooms, usually at his desk by the east windows, with a history book open before him. Dennis didn't like getting up early, but he liked his job very much, and he liked Peter, who was always patient with him, even when he made a mistake. The only time he had ever raised his voice to Dennis was when Dennis had brought him a light lunch and had neglected to put a napkin on the tray. "I'm very sorry, Your Highness," Dennis had said on that occasion. "I just never thought..." "Well, next time, do think," Peter said. He was not shouting, but it was a close thing. Dennis had never neglected to put a napkin on Peter's tray again, and sometimes, just to be safe, he put on 2. Morning chores done, Dennis faded into the background, and his father took over. Brandon was every bit the perfect butler, with his cravat neatly knotted, his hair pulled tightly back and rolled in a bun at the nape of his neck, his coat and breeches without a speck, his shoes shined to a mirror gloss Dennis was responsible for. But at night, with his shoes off, his coat hung in the closet, his cravat loosened, and a glass of bundled gin in his hand, he looked to Dennis a much more natural man. "Tell you something to always be remembering, Denny," he had said to his son on many occasions while in this comfortable state. "There may be as many as 12 things in this world which last, but surely no more, and maybe less. Passionate love of a woman don't last, and a runner's wind don't last, nor does a braggart's wind, nor does haytime in the summer, or sugar time in spring thaw. But 2 things that do last is one, royalty, and another, service. If you stick with your young man until he's an old man, and if you take care of him proper, he'll take care of you proper. You serve him, and he'll serve you, if you take the turn of mind. Now, pour me another glass, and take a drop for yourself, if you like, but no more than a drop, or your mother'll skin us both alive." Undoubtedly, some sons would quickly have grown bored with this catechism, but Dennis did not. He was the rarest of sons, a boy who had reached 20 and still thought his father wiser than himself. On the morning after the king's death, Dennis hadn't had to force himself blearily out of bed at 5 o'clock. He had been awakened at 3 by his father with the news of the king's death. Flags reared up a search party, his father said, eyes full of bloodshot distress. And that's right enough. But my master will be leading it soon enough, I'll warrant, and I'm off to help him hunt for the fiend who'd done it, if he'll have me. Me too, Dennis cried, grabbing for his breeches. Not at all, not at all, his father said with a hard sternness that made Dennis subside at once. Things'll go forward here just as they always have, murder or no. The old ways must be kept to now more than ever. My master and your master will be crowned king at noon. And that's well enough, although he comes to the crown in a bad time. But the death of a king by violence is always an evil thing if it comes not on the field of battle. The old ways will hold, doubt it not, but there may be trouble in the meantime. What's best for you, Dennis, is to go about your work just the same as always. He was gone before Dennis could protest. And when 5 o'clock came, Dennis told his mother what his father had said, and told her he should get about his morning round, even though he knew Peter would be gone. Dennis's mother was more than agreeable. She was dying for news. She told him to go, of course. Go and then come back to her no later than 8 of the clock, and tell her all he heard. So Dennis went to Peter's rooms, which were utterly deserted. Nevertheless, he observed his regular routine, finishing by setting breakfast in the prince's study. He looked ruefully at the plates and glasses, the jams and jellies, reflecting that surely none of those things would be used that morning. Still, going about his ordered course had made him feel better for the first time since his father had turned him out of bed, for he now understood that, for better or worse, things were never going to be the same again. Times had changed. He was preparing to leave when he heard a sound. It was so muffled he couldn't rightly tell where it was, only the general area from which it came. He looked toward Peter's bookcase, and his heart leaped in his chest. Tendrils of smoke were drifting from between the loosely shelved books. Dennis leaped across the room and began pulling books out by double handfuls. He saw that the smoke was issuing from cracks at one side of the bookcase's back. Also, that sound was clearer with the books gone. It was some sort of animal, squeaking in pained distress. Dennis clawed and pawed at the bookcase, his fright spiraling toward panic. If there was one thing people were afraid of in that time and place, it was fire. Soon enough, his fingers happened on the secret spring. Flagg had foreseen this, too. After all, the secret panel wasn't really very secret, enough to amuse a boy, but not much more. The back of the bookcase slid to the right a bit, and a puff of gray smoke wafted out. The smell that escaped with the smoke was extremely unpleasant. A mixture of cooking meat, frying fur, and smoldering paper. Not thinking, Dennis swept the panel all the way open. Of course, when he did that, more air got in. Things which had only been smoldering before now showed the first winks of flame. This was the crucial point, the one place where Flagg had to be content not with what he was sure would happen, but with his best guess of what would probably happen. All his efforts of the last 75 years now swung upon the fragile hinge of what a butler's son might or might not do in the next 5 seconds. But the Brandons had been butlers since time out of mind, and Flagg had decided he must depend on their long tradition of impeccable behavior. If Dennis had frozen in horror at the sight of those blossoming flames, or if he had turned and run for a pitcher of water, all of Flagg's carefully planted evidence might have burned in greenish-tinted flames. The murder of Peter's father would never have been laid at Peter's door, and he would have been crowned king at noon. But Flagg's judgment was right. Instead of freezing or going for water, Dennis reached in and beat the flames out with his bare hands. It took less than 5 seconds, and Dennis was barely singed. The doleful squeaking went on, and the first thing he saw when he had waved the smoke aside was a mouse lying on its side. It was in its death agonies. It was only a mouse, and Dennis had killed dozens of them in the line of duty without the slightest feeling of pity. Yet he felt sorry for this poor little bugger. Something terrible, something he could not even begin to understand, had happened to it, and was still happening to it. Smoke rose from its fur and fine ribbons. When he touched it, he drew his hand back with a hiss. It was like touching the side of a tiny stove, such as the one in Sasha's dollhouse. More smoke drifted lazily from an engraved wooden box with its lid slightly ajar. Dennis lifted the lid a little. He saw the tweezers, the packet. A number of brownish spots had flowered on the packet, and it smoldered sluggishly, but had not burst into flame, nor did it now. The flames had come from Peter's letters, which were, of course, not enchanted at all. It was the mouse that had set these alight with its fearfully hot body. Now there was only the sullenly smoldering packet, and something warned Dennis not to touch it. He was afraid. There were things here that he didn't understand, things he was not sure he wanted to understand. The one thing he knew for sure was that he badly needed to speak to his father. His father would know what to do. Dennis took the ash bucket and a small shovel from beside the stove and went back to the secret panel. He used the shovel to pick up the smoking body of the mouse and drop it into the ash bucket. He wet the charred corners of the letters once more, just to be sure. Then he closed the panel, replaced the books, and left Peter's apartments. He took the ash bucket with him, and now he did not feel like Peter's loyal servant, but like a thief. His booty was a poor mouse that died even before Dennis got back out the west gate of the castle. And before he had even reached his house on the far side of the castle keep, a horrible suspicion had dawned in his mind. He was the first in Delane to feel this suspicion, but he would not be the last. He tried to push the thought out of his head, but it kept coming back. What sort of poison, Dennis wondered, had killed King Roland anyway? Exactly what sort of poison had it been? By the time he got back to the Brandon house, he was in a bad state indeed, and he would answer none of his mother's questions, nor would he show her what was in the ash bucket. He told her only that he must see his father the moment he came in. It was dreadfully important. Then he went into his room and wondered exactly what sort of poison it had been. He only knew one thing about it, but that one thing was enough. It had been something hot. 35. Brandon arrived just before 10 o'clock, short-tempered, exhausted, and in no mood for foolishness. He was dirty and sweaty. There was a thin cut across his forehead, and cobwebs flew from his hair in long strings. They had found no sign of the assassin at all. His only news was that preparations for Peter's coronation were going full speed ahead in the Plaza of the Needle, under the direction of Anders Pena, Delane's judge general. His wife told him of Dennis's return. Brandon's brow darkened. He went to the door of his son's room and rapped not with his knuckles, but with a closed fist. "Come out here, boy, and tell us why you come back with the ash bucket from your master's study."
"No," Dennis said. "You come in here, Dad. I don't want Mother to see what I've got, and I don't want her to hear what we say to each other."
Brandon barged in. Dennis's mother waited apprehensively by the stove, expecting it was some sort of semi-hysterical foolishness which the boy had thought up, some ill-advised monkey shine, and that very soon she would hear Dennis's wails as her tired and distraught husband, who must begin today at noon to buttle not a prince but a king, took out all his fears and frustrations on the boy's backside. She hardly blamed Dennis. Everyone in the keep seemed hysterical this morning, running around like crazy people just let out of bedlam, repeating 100 false rumors, then taking them back in order to repeat 100 new ones. But there were no raised voices from behind Dennis's door, and neither of them came out for more than an hour. When they did, a single look at her husband's white face made the poor woman feel like fainting dead away. Dennis scurried along at his father's heels like a scared puppy. Now Brandon was carrying the ash bucket.
"Where are you going?"
she asked timidly. Brandon said nothing. It seemed that Dennis could say nothing. He only rolled his eyes at her and then followed his father out the door. She saw neither of them for 24 hours and became convinced that both were dead, or even worse, that they were suffering in the dungeon of Inquisition below the castle. Her dire thoughts were not so unlikely, either, for those were a terrible 24 hours in Delane, The day mightn't seem so terrible in some places, places where revolt and upheaval and alarms and midnight executions are almost a way of life. There really are such places, although I wish I didn't have to say so. But Delane had for years, and even centuries, been an ordered and orderly place. So perhaps they were spoiled. That black day really began when Peter was not crowned at noon, and ended with the stunning news that he was to be tried in the Hall of the Needle for the murder of his father. If Delane had had a stock market, I suppose it would have crashed. Construction on the dais, where the coronation was to take place, began at first light. The platform would be a jury-rigged affair of plain boards, Anders Pena knew, but he also knew that enough flowers and bunting would cover the rude spots. They had had no warning of the king's passing, because murder isn't a thing that can be predicted. If it could be, there would be no murders, and the world would almost certainly be a happier place. Besides, pomp and circumstance wasn't the point. The point was to make the people feel the continuity of the throne. If the citizens got the feeling that everything was still all right, in spite of the terrible thing that had happened, Pena didn't care how many flower girls got splinters. But at 11 o'clock, construction abruptly ceased. The flower girls were turned away, many of them in tears, by the home guards. At 7 that morning, most of the home guards had begun dressing in their gorgeous red ceremonial uniforms and their tall, gray, wolf-jaw shakos. They were, of course, to form the ceremonial double line, an aisle down which Peter would walk to be crowned. Then, at 11, they received new orders. Strange, unsettling orders. The ceremonial uniforms came off in a blazing hurry, and their dull, dun-colored combat uniforms went on instead. The showy but clumsy ceremonial swords were replaced with the lethal short swords, which were everyday equipment. Impressive but impractical wolf-jaw shakos were cast aside in favor of the squat leather helmets that were normal battle dress. Battle dress? The very term was distressing. Is there such a thing as normal battle dress? I do not think so. Yet soldiers in battle dress were everywhere, their faces stern and forbidding. Prince Peter has committed suicide. That was the most common rumor which went flying about the castle keep. Prince Peter has been murdered. That one ran a close second. Roland was not dead. It was a mistaken diagnosis. The physician has been beheaded. But the old king is insane and no one knows what to do. That was a third. There were many others, some even more foolish. No one slept as darkness stole over the confused, sorrowing castle keep. All the torches in the plaza of the Needle were lit. The castle blazed with lights, and every house in the keep and on the hills below showed candles and lanterns as frightened people gathered to talk about the day's events. All agreed wild work was afoot. The night was even longer than the day. Mrs. Brandon kept watch for her men in terrible loneliness. She sat at the window, but for the first time in her life, the air was rife with more gossip than she wanted to hear. Yet for all of that, could she stop listening? She could not. As the small hours of the morning stretched out endlessly toward a dawn that she felt would never come, a new rumor began to supplant all the old ones. It was incredible, unbelievable, and yet it was asserted with more and more assurance until even the guards at their posts were repeating it to one another in undertones. This new rumor terrified Mrs. Brandon most of all, because she remembered too well how white poor Dennis's face had been when he had come in with the prince's ash bucket. There had been something inside, something that smelled sick and burnt. Something he wouldn't show her. Prince Peter's been taken in custody for the murder of his father, this awful rumor went. He's been taken. Prince Peter's been taken. The prince has murdered his own father. Shortly before dawn, the distracted woman laid her head in her arms and wept. After a bit, her sobbing faded as she fell into a troubled sleep. 36. Now tell me what's in that bucket, and be quick about it. We want no fooling, Dennis, do you understand me? was the first thing Brandon said when he entered Dennis's room and closed the door behind him.
I'll show you, Dad, Dennis said. But first, answer me one question. What sort of poison was it that killed the king?
No one knows.
What were its ways?
Show me what's in the bucket, boy. Do it now.
Brandon balled a great hard fist. He did not shake it. He only held it up. That